So we are ready to start. Resume traipsing through the tulip field of magnetostatics. Now you're probably all really tired of doing everything in the course so far has been statics, electrostatics, magnetostatics, but we're almost going to start now, very soon, getting into time-dependent phenomena, which after all, is much more exciting. I think we'll all agree. And much harder, but we don't mind that. I didn't quite have time to finish off. Welcome, welcome. Please join the fun. We had started doing this example of a sphere. Had some radius A, we put it in a uniform magnetic field, and we solved for the scalar magnetic potential. Last time, I think we basically ended here, and from this we can calculate anything you might want to calculate. Remember, H is defined to be minus del phi m when there are no free currents. And this leads to the results that H inside is minus the gradient of phi inside, which I'll spare you the algebra, but that's an easy gradient to take. It's 3 b naught over mu plus 2 mu naught unit vector in the z direction. It's a constant magnetic field. And we're often interested in the magnetic induction, not only the magnetic field. This is a linear medium, so it's mu h, which is just 3 mu for mu plus 2 mu naught b naught z hat, also constant inside. And h outside is another easy gradient to take, is b naught z hat over mu naught. Plus this term, which we said is the magnetic field due to a point magnetic dipole, 3 n hat dot m minus m over mu naught 4 pi r cubed. Where the magnetic dipole moment of the sphere is the volume of the sphere, 4 pi a cubed times b naught mu minus mu naught over mu plus 2 mu naught. So, and again, this is the magnetic dipole moment of the sphere, which is induced by putting it in the presence of this uniform magnetic field. You can see, for instance, if the permeability was equal to the free space permeability, that m would be zero, and the field everywhere, the magnetic induction everywhere would just be the applied field, and this sphere would have no effect. So it's kind of reminiscent of right, in electrostatics, if you have a spherical distribution of charge, the potential outside looks exactly as though, and the electric field for that matter, looks exactly as though all the charge was at the origin. Okay, so here you have a magnetized sphere, and when you're outside, it looks as if the magnetic moment is all at the origin, if you are outside of the sphere. On your own, I suggest, as I wrote in the notes, read sections 5.11 and 5.12. And I guess I also, and pages 187 to 191. Okay, so now I have a new topic, which is important, especially in quantum mechanics. The relation, if you have moving charges, they can produce magnetic moments. And they also, when they're moving, then relative to some origin, they have an orbital angular momentum. We'll call that the vector L. So let's start off thinking about a discrete set of particles, like we would normally have in maybe a quantum problem. If we have a discrete set of particles, we can write down the current. Right. If each charge QI has velocity VI, then the current is the sum over all the particles times their velocities times Dirac delta function of their instantaneous positions. So this would be J of X at one moment in time when the particle positions are XI. Did you have a question? No. Right, because we normally think that J could be written in terms of the charge per unit volume times the velocity, right, and the charge per unit volume for a set of discrete particles is QI delta of X minus XI summed over I. Now, to take that to angular momentum, the angular momentum, orbital angular momentum of the ith particle would be its mass, m sub I times its position relative to some origin crossed into its velocity vector at some instant of time. Don't forget that angular momentum depends on your coordinate origin, orbital angular momentum, that is, depends on your coordinate origin. Some people, I think some students forget, like if you have even straight line motion, you know, which you normally think, oh, there's no angular momentum there, but if you refer it to an origin displaced from the velocity vector, this has angular momentum. So, so let's calculate the magnetic dipole moment of such a charge distribution. We have a general formula for that. You all remember, 1/2 the volume integral of x cross j of x d cubed x. Okay, integrated over all the currents, over all the volume that has currents, which if I plug in this with Dirac delta functions, that's a very easy integral to do. And it becomes 1/2 sum over I qi xi cross vi. And then we can see that we can put that, relate that to angular momentum. That will be the sum over I, QI, LI, orbital angular momentum of the ith particle, divided by twice the mass. And if we, for instance, go to a system like maybe electrons in an atom, and we take all the electrons to have the same charge minus E, and mass of the electron, if all of these are minus E over M of the electron, then we get a magnetic dipole moment, which simply adds the angular momenta of every particle weighted by that factor, and we get minus E over twice the mass of the particle times the orbital angular momentum. And this total orbital angular momentum is the sum of for all the particles. So that's the main result I wanted to derive, this relationship between moving charges. If they have an angular momentum about some origin, then they have a magnetic moment. Not surprising, moving in a circular fashion is like a circular current, which is kind of our prototype of magnetic moment. But let's be a little more specific and call this the orbital magnetic moment due to the physical motion through space of the charges. Okay. But in quantum mechanics, thanks to Goudsmit and Uhlenbeck, and maybe I should toss in there Kronig, who kind of all in parallel were starting to realize that to understand atomic spectroscopy, electrons have to have an intrinsic magnetic moment as well as an orbital magnetic moment. And this is all verified experimentally. Basically, we learn that there is a separate source of angular momentum for electrons and for other elementary particles, which usually we call an intrinsic spin angular momentum. And an intrinsic spin magnetic moment. So if we have a picture of an electron as a spinning ball of charge, which actually doesn't really work, people have tried to make models like that of electron spin, and they don't really work. So, but nevertheless, they are felt, they do have angular momentum, and they do have a measurable magnetic moment, and it would be kind of natural to expect them to be proportional. And experiment shows, and eventually theory caught up with this, that the magnetic moment associated with the spin degree of freedom turns out to be something like twice, with a slight correction, times the expected magnetic moment if it were of orbital character, times the spin angular momentum. And this, the two here, not the quantity in parentheses, is derived basically predicted by the Dirac equation. The rest of this in parentheses, you need quantum electrodynamics to understand where that come from. And the first people who understood that, Feynman, Schwinger, and Tominaga, won a Nobel Prize for figuring that out. Okay, so that was just a little aside about angular momentum relation to magnetic moments. Now, want to talk about, we haven't had a tricky derivation now for a lecture or two, so let's give one now with Levi-Civita symbols, all that great stuff. Oh my gosh. Okay, so this derivation is going to be about force and torque on some localized current distribution. Okay, so we're going to have currents. They're going to be in a magnetic field produced by other currents. And there's going to be forces on this current that we're interested in, which might be a wire or it might be just current in free space. And relative to some origin, there might be a torque. So let's focus on the force first. We had earlier, I think, an expression for the force that we wrote in this form earlier in chapter 5 as the cross product between the current density and a magnetic field produced by other currents, again, not by the J of X itself, as a volume integral over the currents J of X. Okay. So what we're going to do with this, just to give you the roadmap, we're going to do a Taylor series of B of X, because again, they were currents far away making B of X. So we can Taylor expand. They shouldn't be varying too fast in space near these currents. And work out some formulas for this force. So I'm visualizing again, the B of X is made by currents far away from the current whose force we want to calculate it on. Okay, so our Taylor expansion, multi-dimensional, our three-dimensional Taylor expansion starts with B of zero. We're going to have in our current that we care about, might be a wire, might not, somewhere in this J of X, we'll have our coordinate origin. And so B of X, the first term will be B of zero. The next term, you remember, for three-dimensional Taylor expansion, will look like X dot gradient of the magnetic field B of X, evaluated then at the origin. And of course, if we need them, there are higher terms lurking that we could include, but I think I won't need them. So the individual components, of course, will just be the individual components, bi at the origin, plus x dot del, acting on the ith component, and I will understand that these are to be evaluated at the origin, and I'm going to make a shorthand notation now. I'm going to write this this x dot del acting on bi as x dot del. It's a little bit of a loose, slightly incorrect notation, but I'll write it this way just to save some writing. X dot del b of 0. The reason it's a bad notation is you would think, oh, the gradient's acting on a constant if you interpret this literally. So don't forget what we mean when we write that. We don't mean to take the gradient of a constant. We take the gradient and then evaluate it at the origin. Okay, so let's plug in our Taylor expansion and we'll work out the force. Alrighty, so we have first term minus b of 0, we can factor out of the integral, and that will be a cross product with the integral of j of x d cubed x, and then the second term will have the integral of j of x crossed into this kind of funny object, x dot del b, evaluated at the origin, d cubed x. So if you remember, in magnetostatics, this integral is 0. So we proved earlier, I think it was on page 154, maybe, of the notes. So let's work on the second term. And I'll rewrite the second term using the magic of Levi-Civita. Thank you, sir, wherever you are, for your symbols. Sum over I, J, and K. We have a cross product, so we just have one Levi-Civita symbol, epsilon I, J, K. Sorry. Yeah, thanks. This will be the kth. Oh, sorry. I actually mean the whole vector. I will have a unit vector, which I'll write this way, ek hat, meaning the kth Cartesian coordinate, its unit vector. And that all can come outside the integral. And then I have ji times x dot del of bj, again, evaluated at the origin, d cubed x. Okay, right? I, j, in this order, will be representing the kth component of j cross this x dot del acting on b. So let me recast that. Notice that ji integral x dot del of bj d cubed x, I can write this as the sum over components of this dot product. I'll call that sum over L. The gradient of bj at the origin, the lth component. Now that's kind of a weird quantity, right? We pick one component, And then we regard that as a scalar function in space. And now we can take its gradient. It'll have three components. And we're looking at the lth component of it now from this dot product. And we're left still with this integral, x lth component times ji, volume integral. And that, in turn, I can rewrite as 1 half sum over L, these L components, gradient of Bj at the origin, Lth component. Times the integral of xl ji minus xi jl d cubed x, where I used equation 5.52 and the discussion below. And sorry, I'm running out of space, but let me put here. This is then finally equal to what I was after this, this quantity here is equal to sum over k x cross j, the k prime component, epsilon L I K prime. Okay. For that to make sense, you might have to go home and think about it. The tricky derivations of magnetostatics. This is one of them. Okay, so now let's put all this together with that identity. We've got the force is a half sum over now I, J, K, L, and K prime. Looks like we're going backward and making things more complicated. Okay. There's a lot of hunger for E&M. We've got our EK unit vector. We've got our Levi-Civita symbol, the first one. We've got our gradient components, the lth component of the gradient of Bj at the origin. We've got our second Levi-Civita tensor, L epsilon LIK prime. And then we've got, the integral of x cross j d cubed x. The K prime component. And now we can use one of these identities. Let me remind you of the kinds of identities we have with Levi-Civita symbols. I think I gave these before, but let me give them again. Sum over epsilon ijk epsilon lik prime. Usually this identity is written not this way, but by permuting these so the index summed over is the first one, but this we can permute cyclically. So I can write that as the sum over I epsilon ijk epsilon ik prime L. And this identity reads that this is delta JK prime delta KL right, these go and these go with the positive sign Kronecker's, and then we have a minus sign with the first and last not summed over and the last and middle. Delta JL delta KK prime. That's the main identity we're going to invoke in a minute, but I can remind you the sum over IJ of epsilon IJK epsilon IJN is twice delta KN, and the sum over IJK epsilon IJK epsilon IJK is just 6. Those are about all the Levi-Civita identities I know. But that's usually enough when you get to these kind of things, these sorts of derivations. You mainly need those. Okay, so we're going to plug that in and replace the sum over I. Get rid of that. Get rid of these and put in here this delta JK prime delta KL minus delta JL delta KK prime. Okay, so there's going to be a lot of zeros. In particular, let's evaluate the sum over, so now the sum over I is gone. It's no longer there. But I want to next evaluate the sum over L and K prime. Okay, that'll collapse all the terms except when K prime is K and in the one term, and when K prime is J in the other term, and so on. So let me not drag that out, just write that down. After that simplification, we'll get still left with two sums over J and K of EK hat. Our good old gradient of B, the jth component at the origin, the kth component of the gradient, times the integral of x cross j, d cubed x, jth component. So that's from the first term in this identity. And then it's minus gradient of b, the origin, the jth component, times the integral x cross j of x, d cubed x, the kth component. Right. Square bracket. The second term is actually zero, because when you sum that over j, you're basically doing del dot b. So we're left only with the first term, and it's looking like we've written it in a form here that shows the magnetic moment of the current. So, in other words, we have come to a rather simple result. The force on this current J, the total force, is the sum over J and K of EK hat, D by DXK now, of BJ of 0, times MJ, where MJ is the jth component of the magnetic moment, which I can also write in an even simpler form as the gradient of M dot B, which is the main result of this derivation. It's a lot of work to get there, but we did it. The magnetic moment has to have the 1/2 times this integral, right? M is 1/2 times this integral. You don't believe a word of that. On the other hand, it's sort of analogous to the force on an electric dipole. In an electric field, right? So it shouldn't be hugely surprising, because we expect the force to be the negative gradient of the energy of a dipole in a field. And we know then we could interpret the energy of the dipole in the magnetic field as minus M dot B. This is the energy of a magnetic dipole placed into an external magnetic field. So you might remember the Stern-Gerlach experiment where they sent neutral particles, actually they were silver atoms, through a magnetic field and deflected the magnetic moments, the atoms, with a magnetic field. And they couldn't just have like a solenoid with a constant magnetic field. They had to have a field which had a gradient, and because if it was a constant magnetic field, this gradient would be zero. So that was the Stern-Gerlach experiment. I guess it probably also won a Nobel Prize. One thing pointed out in our textbook is that this actually cannot be interpreted as the total energy of a magnetic dipole in an external field. And the reason is this energy, minus M dot B energy, it neglects the contribution to the energy in that would be involved in bringing this dipole in from infinity, that this would maintain the steady currents in the power supplies producing that magnetic field. So that is one limitation of this, and we will revisit it in this question in section 516 when we talk about Faraday's law. Which is connected to this point. It's not too hard, I think, once we have gone through this forced derivation, which was pretty nasty. It's not too hard to see how this generalizes if we want the torque on the current distribution. Okay, again, it's referred to some coordinate origin, usually somewhere set up in the around the current distribution. And to calculate that, we have to integrate x prime crossed into the force. And this will be the leading term of that. And for instance, one could use you could rewrite this a different way as the integral of x prime dot b of 0 times j minus x prime dot j b of 0 d cubed x prime is another way to write that. But that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay. Well, I am ready to move on to things changing in time. So let's do that. Much more exciting than just steady currents not doing anything.
And I think the reason that we're stopping at the first term is because the second term would be the quadruple and et cetera.
Yeah, they'd be higher order, would involve gradients of B, and we expect those to be less important. Again, we're thinking the currents that are producing this B are very far away. So those gradients should be small. All right, so Faraday, Michael Faraday. Pretty much the epitome of a self-made man. He's working for famous scientist Davy and ended up really doing more important work, even though he started out as Davy's assistant. So now we're basically going to throw out our assumption throughout this course that nothing changed in time. Now, d rho dt, not zero, yay! dj dt, not zero, yay! Let's talk about experiment to get things going. It's kind of how Jackson proceeds with the kind of simple formulas that were discovered experimentally and go on to derive differential equations describing that physics. So we have to start with some definitions. We're imagining a loop, a closed loop in space, C. And we're going to define a surface to define a surface, we have to first choose the direction we're going to go around this loop. And then, if you go around it in the right-handed sense, the surface will come out in the right-handed sense from that loop. So this doesn't have to be a planar loop, and it doesn't have to be a planar surface. This could be any surface that comes out of that closed loop. And then the normal to that surface everywhere has to be chosen in the, of course, normal, but there are two choices of the normal, and this has to be in the direction implied by the right-hand rule for how we chose to go around the loop. So we have to start with that geometry in mind. And now experiment shows that we can first do some definitions, that we can define the electromotive force, or EMF, as the line integral around that closed loop. That's kind of an odd name, because this is not a force. It doesn't have units of force. And the second definition we're going to need is the magnetic flux through this open surface. B.dA, where again, the sense of direction of dA is in accordance with the right-hand rule. This is the magnetic flux, which Jackson calls F. But I don't like that, so I'm not going to use F. Okay, so Faraday showed that these things are connected by a very simple formula. Namely, this electromotive force, this EMF, is proportional, so there's a constant we'll call K, times the time derivative of this magnetic flux. And in SI units, K is simply 1. In Gaussian units, K is 1 over C. So we're working this semester in SI units. So the units of E are volts. And the units of d phi b dt are in Tesla meter squared for flux over time in seconds. Okay, that's how things look in SI. And here at this point, I have recommended in the notes you should read Jackson's section 515 about the Galilean invariance concept and its relevance to Faraday's law. So all of you who live in the real world may have noticed this is a pretty important law. Most of you, I think. That's where I hang out. So, a few observations about that. First of all, in this loop integral, I guess I already said this, but let me say it again. This loop C can be, like in Gauss's law or Ampere's law, it can be any closed path in space. Not necessarily a wire. It could be a wire. Doesn't have to be. Second point. The flux, the magnetic flux, can change in that derivative. In multiple ways. You could change B in time. That's one way to change the flux. You could change also the shape of the loop in time, its size, or even its orientation. Any of these could also produce a d phi dt. And all of those, this formula still holds for all those possibilities. And don't forget that the physics should not depend on the reference frame. Which will have some implications we'll talk about in a minute. In this formula, though, there is an implicit assumption about the reference frame. It's understood that E is the electric field at the point X where you have your DL, right? Wherever your point X is that has your DL. It's the electric field in the reference frame or coordinate system in which DL is at rest. Important thing we had to say, because otherwise it's not clear, because the electric field is different in different reference frames, as will be explored in great detail when we do relativity next semester. But in fact, you can see some of this already before bringing Einstein's relativity into the argument, by doing a Galilean transformation, which I want to talk about next. That Galileo, he was a wacky funster. Okay. So let's pick a frame of reference. We'll call this the laboratory frame. And let's say E and B are the electric and field and the magnetic induction. Or when I'm being lazy, I might even slip and call that the magnetic field. But you know what I mean. Let these be the fields in the laboratory frame. And let's call E prime the E field in a moving frame that's moving at a velocity V relative to the lab frame. Okay, with respect to a coordinate origin that's moving at velocity V. Relative to the lab frame. And now imagine that there's a charge Q moving at that same velocity in the lab frame, so that basically the second frame is just going along with the charge. In that frame, the charge appears not to be moving. So let's call this charge Q. Which moves at velocity V relative to the lab frame. Then, because the Lorentz forces are this in SI units, for these to be consistent, E prime, the electric field in the moving frame, would have to equal E plus V cross B. So already we have a hint of some things that will be quantified when we do Einstein's relativity, that fields, electric and magnetic, what they are in one frame looks different in a different frame. Okay, but let's come back to Faraday's law and do this thing that our textbook author likes to do, boil down Faraday's law that I've just presented as an experimental fact, boil that down to a differential equation. So let's consider, so this is our differential equation derivation corresponding to Faraday's law. We're going to consider some arbitrary time-independent loop. And we'll call it C as before. Then we're going to write Faraday's law, as I've already written it, minus d by dt of the magnetic flux, which is minus the surface integral of partial b with respect to time. You see why I had to change to a partial now. Phi b here is only a time-dependent quantity. If I have a fixed loop, the flux only is some number depending on time. It doesn't depend on x or any other variable because it's an integral over position already. So this total derivative is now a surface integral, bringing the derivative inside the integral. It's now a partial derivative because b does depend on position as well as time, dotted into dA. And that's what has to equal, according to Faraday's law, this line integral around the closed loop. Then we have Stokes' theorem. That closed loop integral is integral over the curl dotted into dA. You might correct your notes. I erroneously in the lecture notes wrote that as dl. I think I didn't get around to correcting it before I posted it. But now we invoke the fact that the loop C was totally arbitrary. This could be any loop bounded by any open surface, or that bounds, I should say, bounds any open surface. And the only way these two things could be equal for arbitrary loop is if the integrands are equal. So when you're proving this, you have to say those words or write those words, like on an exam. You have to say, it's crucial that this is not just for one particular loop, one particular surface, that these are equal. It's because they are equal for all possible choices of the loop could be made arbitrarily small. That because of that, we can conclude the integrands are equal. And so we have a differential equation describing Faraday's law. Voila. And so this generalizes our result from electrostatics, where we had del cross E is zero when nothing can change in time. Del cross E is zero. Okay. I don't have that in top of my head, but it's at the standard one that I guess Purdue publishes the final schedule. You can find that online. I think it will give the room number and the time and date. It's in December. Does that help? Hot chocolate, I think, would be allowed, yeah. Okay, so the next topic is also kind of a tricky one. We're used to that. We can handle that. Is how to think about energy in the magnetic field. And so what we're going to think up now is what happens as we, increase J from maybe charges were sitting around, we got them to move somehow. We got these moving, and we're going to ramp up the currents from zero. And we're going to use Faraday's law to account for the fact that we are going to have to perform work against the induced EMF. In fact, I forgot to say this, but don't forget this minus sign means that this work being done as you do this is opposing the change, what is usually called Lenz's law. Which is useful as you are trying to figure out the sign of the EMF or the electric field. Okay, so we're going to basically see what happens to the energy as we ramp up our current. And what we're going to use as our main tool is use Faraday's law. And this will account for the fact that we're doing work against the induced EMF as we are increasing that current. That's the logic of this derivation. And then we're going to interpret that work that we're going to come up with, a formula for it. We're going to interpret that work as the energy stored in the magnetic field. And moreover, we will calculate the rate at which work is being done as an important quantity. And we can think of that by the battery or power supply doing the work. As this will be a power, the rate of change of that energy in time, which we could also equate to minus I times E, where E we have from Faraday's law, minus d phi b dt. And so we'll have that dw dt, the rate of which the power supply has to supply energy will be I d phi dt. Okay, so let's imagine flux through a circuit. You can imagine a wire if you want. It's kind of easier to visualize this in a wire, but it doesn't have to be. It's just a fixed loop. And let's imagine the flux through a circuit. That's carrying some current I at the moment. that flux changes from phi b to phi b plus delta phi b. Okay. Then the work done by external sources should equal delta W, we'll call it. That amount of work should be I times delta phi B, where I've assumed no ohmic losses. Superconducting wires. Okay. So let's pursue that. Again, phi b is the integral of b dot n hat, b dot dA, which is b dot n hat times the differential area element, which is also the integral of the curl of A, the vector potential, dotted into dA, where we can again use Stokes' theorem and write that as a loop integral around our circuit of A dot dl. And so using that form of the flux, we can rewrite this delta phi b in terms of A, delta A. For this change, the current times the loop integral of delta A dot dl. And we've seen before that we could change the integral of I dl into an integral of J d cubed x into a volume integral over J. So this can also be written as delta A dotted into J d cubed x. But now we have an equation for J as the curl of H. This is the free currents now. They control H. And so we have another form. Delta W is the integral of delta A dotted into the curl of H d cubed x. You can imagine we're going to do an identity now. With the identity I'm going to invoke is del dot p cross q for two vector general vector functions p and q is q dot del cross p minus p dot del cross q, and p will be h here, and Q will be delta A. And that allows us to write, oh my God, I've gone over my time. Guess I'm gonna have to finish this definition last time. Let me give you the punchline, but I'll finish this off next time. The final formula, which is the fundamental formula for this work done, is H dotted into delta B d cubed x. We'll talk more about that next time, and I'll finish off how we get to that with the last couple of identities. And sorry, I went over. Come see me on Wednesday, or I'll be lonely. in office hours or outside of office hours.